Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Trip Planner by Expedia. You were made to have strong opinions about sand. We were made to help you and your friends find a place on the beach with a pool and a marina and a waterfall and a soaking tub. Expedia. Made to travel.
Where do I see myself in 5 years? I want to buy a camper van with a sweet solar-powered kitchenette and space for my best friend, too. Yes, you.
Let's get started on your 5-year plan. CIBC. Ambitions made real.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 21st of January, these are our main stories. Iran warns Israel of reprisals following an airstrike on Damascus in Syria that killed 5 members of Tehran's Revolutionary Guard.
At around 10:30, we heard the sound of 3 consecutive explosions. They targeted the building here behind us. We were shocked and shaken.
In the Democratic Republic of Congo, Felix Tshisekedi is sworn in as president again.
Élu président de la République démocratique du Congo.
Slovakia's prime minister says he'll veto Ukraine's bid to join NATO. Also in this podcast, Nikki Haley questions Donald Trump's mental fitness ahead of the Republican presidential primary in New Hampshire. And
she actually had a duplication of her pelvis, so she was quite remarkable looking.
Stay tuned to find out about a dog that needed an operation to become a 4-legged friend. The Middle East has been on a heightened alert since the 7th of October attack by Hamas on Israel. That resulted in Israel's military response in Gaza and increasing tensions spilling across borders. Now, 5 members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, including the head of their information unit, have been killed by an airstrike on the Syrian capital, Damascus. Iran has been quick to pin blame on Israel, with Tehran declaring it reserves the right to respond. This local resident, Salama, heard the blast from his home in the Syrian capital.
At around 10:30, we heard the sound of 3 consecutive explosions. They targeted the building here behind us. We were shocked and shaken. Everything is broken. The fence flew from the building that was struck and came into our kitchen.
Our correspondent, Mark Lowen, is in Jerusalem, and I asked him, is Israel likely to be behind Saturday's attack?
It's very likely to be behind this attack, but we are very unlikely to hear a confirmation from the horse's mouth here in Israel, because Israel very rarely confirms that it is behind military operations abroad. But as you say, Val, there have been hundreds of Israeli strikes in Syria during the course of the Syrian civil war and on Iranian-backed positions. There was another suspected Israeli airstrike on Christmas Day, actually, that killed a senior Iranian general in Syria. Earlier this month, an Israeli strike, presumed Israeli strike, killed a top Hezbollah commander, that is the pro-Iranian militia in Lebanon, and that commander was killed in Lebanon. So Israel has frequently militarily reached beyond its borders, and the fear continues, really, that the Gaza conflict will continue to spill over into this wider volatile region, which it has already done, given these strikes and the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon, attacks involving Iran and Iranian proxies. And, you know, this is such a volatile region that that fear has only been confirmed, of course, with the attack today.
And why are the Iranian Revolutionary Guards in Syria?
They back President Assad and have been providing important military backing and political backing to the Assad regime for years. And of course, Iran is the big Shiite power in this region. Its tentacles reach way beyond Iran into Lebanon, supporting Hezbollah, into Yemen, supporting the Houthis there, into Gaza itself, arguably supporting Hamas. And it is the big enemy of Israel. And the Iranian foreign ministry spokesperson said that they reserved the right to respond to Israel at an appropriate time, and they said that this was the murderous Zionist regime once again.
And this, of course, is against the background, as you said, of heightened tensions because of Gaza in the region.
Yeah, obviously the most intense of military activity is still in Gaza itself. Israeli forces are pushing harder and deeper into southern Gaza. They are convinced that top Hamas officials are holed up or beneath the southern Gazan city of Khan Yunis, and the Hamas authorities in Gaza have reported the highest number of people killed in a 24-hour period so far this year, about 165 people killed in overnight shelling in southern Gaza on Friday night. So even though we're talking about these missiles beyond the region that has captured the headlines today, we can't lose sight of the fact that ground zero is still Gaza, of course, itself. The situation there is getting worse, and of course for the population in Gaza it is incredibly serious, with the UN saying that only 15 bakeries are now still operational, and they've warned that famine is stalking the entire population of Gaza.
Mark Lowen in Jerusalem. And staying in Israel, thousands of people have attended rallies in Tel Aviv calling for immediate elections so a new government can be put in place to resolve the war in Gaza. Alma Ganahar is one of them.
I'm completely against this war. There's too many casualties. I think this war is about revenge and not about a political sense. The war doesn't give us any future. There's too many victims, too much sorrow, too much pain. Again, we must get to a political resolution, to a new arrangement. We cannot continue to live like this. These people are not our enemies, not this majority of civilians that are living in Gaza.
Maoz Inon lost his parents in the October the 7th attacks. He urged countries to stop giving unlimited backing to Israel.
All the world leaders, start supporting Israel with no condition and unlimited support. Send us aid of reconciliation, peace, aid of shared initiatives between Jews, Arabs, Israelis and Palestinians.
As the war continues and the number of Palestinians being killed in Gaza rises every day, the reverberations are being felt in Palestinian diaspora communities around the world. Sally Nabil went to the US suburb of Bridgeview in Chicago in Illinois, which has long been known as Little Palestine.
Everything around us just feels so Palestinian, so Arab. Sometimes you can even forget that you are in the US. We've seen restaurants and stores having their names written in Arabic, the Palestinian flag hanging down from some balconies, billboards calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. But this show of solidarity can sometimes come with a high price.
This is the famous sign.
Since the fighting broke out in Gaza, Leila has had a sign that reads Free Palestine in her garden. As we stand next to the sign, Leila, a U.S.-born mother of three, explains to me that since putting it up, she has received two letters containing death threats.
I have no trust now with anybody. And I'm going to tell you, I'm a friendly, friendly person. I say hi to everybody. But now I have my guard up. I'm not as friendly as I used to be.
What has changed?
The fear. The fear of not knowing who's behind the letter. Is this somebody that I'm shopping with? Is this somebody that's in the school with my kids? Somebody that I wave to in the morning. I don't know. And that's what scares me.
Leila doesn't only fear for the lives of her three boys, but she's also concerned that her identity as a Muslim woman who wears a headscarf might make her a target.
It's not being able to go outside whenever I want to go outside. Sometimes I get scared that maybe the person will come and try to take one of my kids. Just to get back at me. I've explained to my kids, if you see somebody trying to hurt me, you run back into the house and don't try to save me. Just run back.
Did it ever occur to you that that might happen?
Yes, because it happened to Wadia. So it can happen to me.
Wadia Al-Fayoumi was a six-year-old Palestinian-American boy stabbed to death in the apartment where he lived with his mom. The suspect, his landlord, has been charged with murder and hate crimes. Wadia was Uday's only child. The man takes me into the room where his son used to sleep when he visited him on weekends. Uday migrated to the U.S. 8 years ago, dreaming of a better life. He tells me he hasn't shed a tear yet over his son's tragic death.
I still hear his voice. He used to come on Saturdays, and up till now, I still stand next to the window waiting for him. I know he won't show up, but it just relieves me to wait.
But over the past couple of months, a few Palestinian support rallies took place in Chicago, where various communities came together to call for an end to the war. Hatem Aboudia from the U.S. Palestinian Community Network says solidarity is essential.
For Palestine support rallies, these are absolutely the biggest that Chicago has ever seen, especially other oppressed communities, the Black community in the United States, Latino community, other immigrant communities, the Native communities here, Asian, have always been on the side of the Palestinian people.
A voice there from Bridgeview in Chicago, Illinois, and that report was by Sally Nabil. The Prime Minister of Slovakia, Robert Fico, says he's ready to veto Ukraine's bid for membership of the NATO military alliance, claiming it would spark a global conflict. He said his government would offer humanitarian aid, but no military support. Rob Cameron has the details.
Robert Fico will have his first meeting with his Ukrainian opposite number, Denis Shmyhal, on Wednesday, and as he told Slovak Radio, he's ready to speak his mind. There was no military solution to the conflict, he said. Instead, there should be negotiations. Russia will never leave the Donbass and Crimea, he said, and everyone realises this. And as for Ukraine's bid to join NATO, the Slovak Prime Minister told listeners he would veto it, claiming it would lay the foundations for the Third World War.
Rob Cameron. Now to the Democratic Republic of Congo, where Felix Tshisekedi has been sworn in for a controversial second term.
Moi, Monsieur Tshisekedi Tshilombo Félix Antoine, élu président de la République démocratique du Congo.
The ceremony, attended by a dozen African heads of state, took place in a packed stadium in the capital, Kinshasa. In his speech, the president vowed to tackle violence in the east of the country, where the M23 is battling other armed groups for control of the mineral-rich region. Our reporter, Emery Makomeno, was at the inauguration.
It was quite brief. President Tshisekedi took the oath of office before the Constitutional Court judges. The people who came in thousands in the stadium have been waiting for the moment all day long. So everything went on very well with jubilation and singing and dancing from the public here at the biggest football stadium in the DRC.
Were there any signs of protests because the opposition is refusing to recognize Felix Tshisekedi's election victory, isn't it?
Three presidential candidates did, of course, call for a protest. But Martin Fayulu and Moise Katumbi and also Floribert Anzuluni did not give any indication of any rally place where people would have to gather. But yes, the three are still rejecting the 73% that President Felix Tshisekedi was accredited. They say these elections were marred with fraud, with ballot stuffing. These are allegations that were rejected by the Constitutional Court.
And Mr. Tshisekedi is facing huge challenges in the country, isn't he? What's he going to address first?
Well, they did mention problem of insecurity in the eastern part of the DRC, where we have at least 7 million people who are internally displaced because of an ongoing conflict that has been happening there for over two decades. But there is also unemployment within the youth in particular. I say that these are some of his biggest challenges to tackle first, but there is also the problem with the instability of the economy. Those are some of the few issues that he said short after the inauguration during his first speech.
Emery Makomeno in Kinshasa. Fans of the global hit TV series Succession may know it won 6 Emmy TV awards recently to add to its haul of 4 Golden Globes. If you haven't seen the series, it depicts a vicious struggle for power in the filthy rich and totally dysfunctional family of fictional media mogul Logan Roy. It's a toxic mix of extreme wealth, media, politics, all infused with a modern take on Shakespeare's King Lear. Well, the BBC's Nick Robinson has been speaking to Succession's creator and writer Jesse Armstrong and asked him why a story about such unpleasant people is so compelling.
I can't explain its success. I didn't think about it in those terms when we started out. Although the things that the characters do and their moral behaviour is sometimes reprehensible and the stuff they do to the world has bad outcomes, I don't think of them as irredeemable. I guess I think of them as the products of their family, their environment, their culture. And within those contexts, their actions are sort of maybe more explicable, if not excusable.
When people first saw the series, they inevitably said, ah, yes, it's the Murdochs. And then people said, oh, there's a bit of the Maxwells there.
My sense is you looked at powerful, dysfunctional families dating back not just decades, but centuries.
Dead right. I mean, those succession moments, you know, have been terrific meat and drink for writers forever. And imperial succession, royal succession, corporate succession have all fed in. Obviously, you know, we have a right-wing TV news network like Rupert Murdoch had and has still. So there's that clear parallel. But then we also have a cruise line and, you know, Sumner Redstone has been mentioned, Conrad Black, that people in the media will be able to see lots and lots of storylines that we've taken from the real world.
Do you, in a curious way, though, owe Donald Trump? I was going to say a thank you. I doubt you'll ever say that. It could be argued that Trump helped create the backdrop which gave people the appetite for succession. You had your first read-through of the script, didn't you, on the day he was elected?
That's dead right. And yeah, and I have reflected on that somewhat ruefully or with mixed feelings that I think you're, you know, it's a counterfactual. I don't know how it would have landed in a Clinton presidency. There may have been other issues which had made it feel salient. But yeah, I think this kind of imperial, rather gross in some ways, family and their internecine fighting did fit that Trump era and the long tail we've had on it, which still possibly has a rattle on that tail.
Now, great characters you've described, characters that in a way you empathised with, that you even liked. How about a spin-off of one of those? I mean, it worked for Cheers. They got Frasier. You know, there are plenty of characters I could think of a spin-off for.
Well, yeah, it's nice that people can feel that life, but that doesn't feel like the most interesting thing to do to me.
Not even a Greg, given that you're the Greg.
I mean, if I had to, I would like to, but sadly, I feel like me in the writer's room have written them enough now.
Jesse Armstrong, the writer and creator of the TV series Succession, speaking there to Nick Robinson. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
I'm sorry, I heard you, leader of the pack.
Tributes are paid to Mary Weiss, the lead singer of the Shangri-Las, who's died at the age of 75. In the United States, the Republican presidential hopeful Nikki Haley has questioned Donald Trump's mental fitness as campaigning intensifies ahead of the New Hampshire primary on Tuesday. The former UN ambassador raised the issue after Mr. Trump appeared to confuse her with the Democrat politician Nancy Pelosi, falsely accusing her of failing to stop the January the 6th attacks on the Capitol. The former president is also being challenged by the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis. From Washington, Will Vernon reports.
5 days ago, Donald Trump won the Iowa caucuses with a record-breaking 51% of the vote, with his two closest rivals, Nikki Haley and Ron DeSantis, trailing him by around 30 points. Now, Mr. Trump appears set for a resounding victory in the state of New Hampshire, where he's on around 50%, according to the latest polling. The former UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, who seems to be pinning all her hopes on success in the state, is currently on around 34% in the polls. Today, she questioned Mr. Trump's mental fitness for office after he appeared to confuse her with the former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi during a campaign speech.
They're saying he got confused, that he was talking about something else. He was talking about Nancy Pelosi. He mentioned me multiple times in that scenario. We can't have someone else that we question whether they're mentally fit to do this. We can't.
Nikki Haley has stepped up her attacks on Mr. Trump in recent days, framing the race as a two-person contest between her and the former president. The Florida governor, Ron DeSantis, is in a distant third place in New Hampshire, polling in the single digits. Pressure is now mounting on Ms. Haley. If she fails to produce a strong result, it may prove almost impossible to prevent Donald Trump's march towards the Republican nomination.
Will Vernon. India is planning to build a fence along its border with Myanmar, according to India's Interior Minister Amit Shah, in an effort to boost security. The two countries have more than 1,600 kilometres of shared border. A South Asia regional editor and Barasan Etherajan told me why thousands of people have been moving across it in recent years.
India's northeast shares border with Myanmar. As of now, there is a conflict going on in Myanmar itself. Various insurgent groups, ethnic communities, they are fighting against the Myanmar army. So thousands of people, ethnic communities have been fleeing. In addition to that, after the Arakan rebel army overran several towns and military camps in Myanmar, in fact, a couple of days ago, more than 275 Myanmar soldiers also fled to India. Of course, most of these soldiers were repatriated to Myanmar because India and Myanmar, they have close relations. But it also shows how the India's northeast shares very close ethnic, cultural and linguistic connections with Myanmar, and the border is open. And now there is also an ethnic conflict going on in the state of Manipur, where there is a Métis population where they are living mostly in the valley, and the indigenous community called Kuki. So they live in the up in the hills. These communities, they share close relations with the same people on the other side of the border. So now the government suspects that some of these militant groups on the Indian side getting help from the people on the other side. And that is why the government is now contemplating fencing this nearly 1,600 kilometer border.
But that would be a huge undertaking, wouldn't it?
It will cost a lot of money. It will take a long time. It's going to be a big challenge because it is a very difficult terrain. I've been to Mori, which is the border town in Manipur state, and the border is open. You can just walk across the Myanmar side and come back. You know, this is a history behind this. Until 1937, Burma, Myanmar called now, was part of British India, and then they became separate. And even after India gained independence from Britain, the people along this border were allowed to move across because they were from the same communities. It was between two colonies before. Now you have an international border. So to allow the movement of people, the governments initially agreed for 40 kilometers they can move from this side to that side without any passport or visa. Then it was later reduced to 16 kilometers. Now, if you put this fence across, it is going to divide these communities. They have marital relationship. They do trade. This is all informal trade between ethnic indigenous communities. And that is going to anger because already this region is very tense with competing claims by various ethnic communities. And it is going to increase the anger. What the analysts say are likely to lose the goodwill of these indigenous communities.
And Barasan Etherajan. One of the world's top prizes for architecture has been awarded to a woman who hasn't herself built that much, but has been one of the most distinctive and influential voices of her generation. The Royal Institute of British Architects gave its gold medal to Leslie Locko, a Ghanaian Scottish teacher and author whose mission, in the words of her citation, has been to democratise, decolonise and reimagine architecture. Tim Franks asked her how she felt when she heard she'd won the prize.
I was really knocked sideways because I'm not a practising architect. This sort of award, just I never thought it would come to someone like me. So it was an enormous surprise. And then when I picked myself up, I kind of thought, wow, yeah, it's special.
It is special. You do touch on the fact that you are not somebody who has a great body of buildings behind you. I was reading that you got your PhD by building a mud brick house.
Yes, my own house, yes.
Yeah, which, I mean, is a wonderful thing to do. Given that you're not an architect, I know that the citation says that you've been phenomenally influential in terms of what you have brought to architecture. What would you say you would immodestly like to think of as your distinctive contribution?
For me, it goes back to something that the most influential tutor I had, Jonathan Hill, who passed away last year, said to me, that the term architect is protected in law, but fortunately the term architecture has no such legal protection, and that architecture is a wider category than the building of buildings. I have to say, I genuinely believe it. In some ways, it's almost coincidental that these interests in kind of climate change and social justice and equity and racial justice have come about now, sort of 30 years after I first started looking at them. But I think without that wider understanding of architecture, it would be quite hard to find space for those kinds of concerns.
And I suppose, actually, I mean, it is an absolute truism, isn't it, to say that architecture is about buildings and buildings are about people, about environments, about the ways in which they're used, how they're placed and all the rest of it.
100%. And also, I mean, buildings shape the way we are in the world with each other and with the environment. But it's a much broader category than the bricks and mortar. And so this award, I think, has really thrown a spotlight on that.
Tell me about the practice of architecture in particular in Africa, because, I mean, I know that that's something that you've championed in all sorts of ways, but I was reading, I think it was a quote from you that said that in a continent of almost a billion, there are fewer than 90 accredited architecture schools, which seems stunning.
It is on the one hand, but I think we have to remember that the vast majority of buildings are done without architects. So it's not to say that there isn't a huge energy and a huge amount of building going on, but the training of an architect is still quite a specialist and elitist subject. And I think the attempt to broaden who sees themselves as, you know, potential architect is really important. I think of my niece who just qualified actually in the UK. She just got her Part 3 as an architect. And the world of architecture that she's coming into is a very different one than the world that I entered. So in some ways, I hope that this award shows people, especially on the home continent, that actually anything's possible, that you can be involved in the built-in environment in many different ways. I mean, I think in my year at the Bartlett, I think there were two people of colour, and I think there were six women. I mean, I might have got that wrong. It's about 30 years ago. But
out of how many?
100, maybe? And it's a very, very different world now. But I also think that in terms of understanding writing and filmmaking and installation and art and sociology and politics as being part of, let's say, architectural language, that's very different to what it was like 30 years ago when it was literally plan, section, elevation and history of architecture. And it was a particular kind of history as well. I think that's definitely changed. And I think the architecture field that I entered 30 years ago was incredibly siloed. You know, the separation between an architect and an urbanist, between a landscape architect, between an interiors, all of those things were very tightly monitored. I think the world is much more fluid now. And Africa is an amazing place to cross disciplinary boundaries, partly because that infrastructure of segregation isn't as strong there.
Leslie Locko speaking there to Tim Franks. The lead singer of the Shangri-Las, Mary Wise, has died at the age of 75. The Shangri-Las were a New York singing group back in the 1960s, made up of two sets of sisters, and with hits like Leader of the Pack, they're often considered to be the precursor to the so-called girl bands. They were contemporaries of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and performed with both groups. And some of the Shangri-Las' songs did have a fairly morbid element, as music journalist Simon Price explains.
They had these bright, cheerful pop hits like Give Him a Great Big Kiss.
Here comes my guy, walking down the street. Look how he walks, with a dancing beat.
But overwhelmingly, there was this certain American Gothic eeriness to what they did, this undercurrent of sadness and tragedy. If you look at songs like I Can Never Go Home Anymore, it's a song of regret about being cruel to her dead mother. Perhaps the strangest, past, present and future, is Mary alludes to some unspecified trauma, which means she's unable to love.
Past is filled with silent joys and broken toys.
And they made several of what was known as death discs. In their breakthrough hit, Remember Walking in the Sand, Mary's reminiscing about a boyfriend who's dead. And their first number one, Leader of the Pack, is about her fiancé dying in a motorcycle crash, complete with sound effects. There was this whole craze for death discs in the 60s, but the Shangri-Las did it better than anyone. I think Mary's voice brought this kind of shrill melodrama to those songs. People talk about teen pop, and yeah, the Shangri-Las' music was written by older people, but they were genuine teenagers. Mary was 15 when they started having hits, and they were from Queens in New York, and they brought this kind of attitude to what they did, and that had a direct influence on punk and new wave. Debbie Harry of Blondie was a huge admirer. The first ever punk single, New Rose by the Damned, begins with the words, "Is she really going out with him?" which is taken from Leader of the Pack. And Joe Jackson's first hit was actually called, "Is she really going out with him?" And then, of course, you've got the influence on girl groups, because along with other 60s girl groups, such as the Ronettes and the Supremes, the Shangri-Las really paved the way for people like Bananarama and TLC, Spice Girls, Sugar Babes, Girls Aloud, and Amy Winehouse is known to have been a big fan.
Simon Price on Mary Wise, the lead singer of the Shangri-Las, who's died at the age of 75. And finally, to the very unusual case of Ariel, a spaniel who was found abandoned in the car park of a supermarket in Wales when she was just 11 weeks old. Ariel was born not with four, but with six legs, two of them conjoined. Now, thanks to well-wishers around the world, almost $20,000 was raised to have the two extra legs removed. Aruna Iyengar reports on the dog's progress.
Ariel, who's captured the hearts of so many, appears to have taken this operation in her stride. The six-month-old is now bounding around after surgery on Wednesday. Langford Vets in Bristol managed to save all four of Ariel's normal legs. Aaron Lutchman was one of the surgeons.
So she actually had a duplication of her pelvis. So she had an extra pelvis with an extra limb. On that extra limb, she also had two additional paws. So she was quite remarkable looking.
Mikey Lawler from Greenacres Animal Rescue in Haverford West looked after Ariel from the start and organised the crowdfunding to raise money for the operation.
She's recovered really well. She's been eating, drinking, going out for a walk, spending lots of time with the nurses. She's very popular there. They're really, really happy with her recovery.
Greenacres will be looking for a permanent home for Ariel in the coming months, but for now she's being taken back to her foster family in West Wales for a rest and some doggy treats.
A happy tale there from Aruna Iyengar. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Alicia Thursting, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.